This is Unwelcome Guests. You're listening to a conversation with UC Berkeley biologist Ignacio Chapella. You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, W201CD Ithaca Community Radio on 88.1 FM, or Free Radio Santa Cruz. We continue with the conversation with Dr. Chapella on the story of corn.
We are all connected in a very real sense, in a very physical sense. So it's not as trivial as it would seem. Yes, of course, if you are thinking of, you know, 1, 2, 10 generations of humans, that is not a problem. And then we say, well, it's a risk. You know, I'm going to go to Phil Campbell's level and talk about this movie Shrek, when you have the dictator say, and I'm going to send you to find my princess and fight for her. And of course, many of you are going to die, but it's a risk I'm willing to take. You know, it's the same position that we in this generation are very willing to take risks for 10 generations down the line. So who cares if they get contaminated with corn manipulations that were done in Iowa in 2002? I think there is a new sense of social justice that biotechnology brings that has to do with intergenerational responsibility that environmentalists had already established many years ago, but biotechnologists are establishing in a very real physical sense. The transformations of life that we're doing today are having major repercussions into the future. There are so many things that we do not know, and it's this unknown part of it that we should really be worrying about what we're doing, what we're releasing out there, and what our own descendants are going to be facing these 10 generations down the line when they meet the transformations that we've introduced into corn in a very real physical sense in their own genomes. What is going to happen? We have no idea.
I wanted to be sure we talk about you a little bit, because you've talked about ideas and history, but you are at the vortex of it right now. Your job is at stake. People have tried to bribe you, and people have tried to threaten you. So you belong into the story.
There are really unprecedented things about what's happened around that story that carries my name with it. The fact that the scientific establishment in the form of this Nature magazine would do something unprecedented in its 133-year history tells me that there is something very serious about what's happening out there and about the questions that have not been asked. I think it's not about the question that we asked, it's about all the questions that were not asked. And then how the scientific establishment has had to go into high gear to discredit, to by any means possible, get rid of the story, finish it off, say, this is it, we give closure, everybody go home, and nothing happened here. And how they were willing to play this totally unusual role as, you know, judge and jury and executioner all rolled into one, and actually one individual, the editor of Nature, who I happen to know as a very intelligent and actually quite thoughtful person. What are the forces out there that all of a sudden conjured up this action at this crux in history, at this crux in time, in the development of these technologies, in the development of what is this so-called globalized market and globalized world? If you can derail the whole ag biotech machinery, and to a large extent the whole scientific establishment machinery, because it actually is what happened, with $2,000 worth of work, there's something seriously wrong with it, I think. I think the most interesting thing for me is that the story continues to roll, because that means that people are just tired of having the wool pulled over their eyes. The fact that people are interested in the story is, again, not something about the story itself, but about the fact that we've had so much of denying that nothing is happening, denying that people have anything to say, leaving the questions to the experts, and not allowing anybody to ask questions about what the consequences are of our actions internationally. You know, you are like, oh, it's okay if you think about what your actions are here in Berkeley and in California and so on, but don't ask any questions about what your feeding habits have to do with Rwanda, right? I think people are fed up with that, and people want change. The main story is not about me. It's not about corn. It's not about, not even about humanity's food source. It's about the takeover of something that we hold very dear, which is a democratic society and a representative society and a society that is more or less, you know, for better or for worse, led by reason, and how this is being hijacked and the mechanisms through which it's being hijacked. And that seems to be the most interesting story for people who are asking questions these days.
That was Ignacio Chapela, Assistant Professor of Microbial Ecology at the University of California, Berkeley. He wrote a report for the science magazine of record, Nature, on the contamination of the Zapotecan corn in Oaxaca, Mexico. Unprecedented in its over 100-year history, and apparently pressured by a huge campaign by the biotech industry, the magazine tried to make him retract his findings. Chapela and his grad student, David Quist, stood by their work. The findings were confirmed by other labs. And this is where the meeting ended. Chapela, three friends of mine, including the writer and historian Ian Bull, had met in a Berkeley bookstore. But as I went home, one comment by Ignacio Chapela haunted me. What exactly did he mean when he said that these changes made to corn could eventually affect our human genome as well? Here's his answer.
The question was, how could we see these manipulations of transgenic manipulations of DNA in other species come back to humans? And I see two ways. One, which is the biological route, which is totally speculative but not implausible and not unlikely, and that is a process called horizontal gene transfer. We know that we are connected with the rest of, you know, DNA-based, carbon-based life over evolutionary time. You know, when Haeckel and Darwin and those people were thinking of evolution, they used to think of evolution as a continuously expanding tree, with branches always diverging away from each other. You have pure lines that are just always getting purer and purer and kind of diverging away from them. DNA work, this molecular biology knowledge, has helped us realize that that's not really the case, the way evolution happens. There is a lot of what's called reticulation, where you have feedback, movement of genetic material from one of these branches to the other. So what we have is really a net of life, of interconnected life. The rate of movement is very low, especially for organisms like ourselves that are really good at telling self from non-self and really good at pushing out bacteria that come into your body and so on. But, I mean, some of you might be surprised that you are actually, every one of your cells is actually made not of a cell that you can call, you know, pure Aryan or whatever your race might be, but it's actually made of your cells or the cells of your ancestors, plus bacteria that have been incorporated into it through evolutionary time that you call your mitochondria. Those mitochondria really evolved from, or are the descendants of, a totally different evolutionary lineage than the other part of your ancestors. You know, so they met at some point. So there are routes through which we should expect over evolutionary time to see the interconnectedness of life operate like that. I think there are much better, much easier ways of thinking about this question, and that is how it is that we are using the technology to transform humans. And I know that tonight we've been talking a lot about ag biotech, and that a lot of public attention goes to ag biotech and biotech in the environment, but the technology itself denies the difference between humans and non-humans. That's the whole point of the technology. So there are incredible advances out there that are pointing to or are aiming at transforming the human genome by incorporating either pieces from other humans, but also pieces from other organisms, or producing pigs that will carry proteins, that human proteins or human genes, and express that. So we are trying, we are really working at erasing the difference between between species in the lab.
That was the story of corn as told by Ignacio Chapella, assistant professor of microbial ecology at the University of California, Berkeley.
For more information or a copy of the story of corn with Dr. Ignacio Chapella, please visit TUC Radio's website at www.tucradio.org. Thanks to Mariah Gallardon for providing that material to us. The latest project of the biotech industry is the modification of plants to produce pharmaceuticals and industrial chemicals. What's most alarming to many scientists, food safety activists, and environmentalists is that, once again, corn is the target species. Diane Horn spoke with Dr. Jane Rissler of the Union of Concerned Scientists.
The cost of pharmaceuticals in the U.S. is skyrocketing, and drugs are increasingly unaffordable. One solution is, through genetic engineering, to turn select plants into biological factories for pharmaceuticals, the hope being to bring down costs and even to provide previously unavailable drugs. But what if these pharmaceutical crops contaminate our food supply and find their way into our cornflakes? Can we find a way to safely grow pharmaceutical crops, or do the risks outweigh the benefits? To help answer these questions, we have as our guest Dr. Jane Rissler, Senior Staff Scientist at the Union of Concerned Scientists. First, what is the position of the Union of Concerned Scientists on the genetic engineering of plants?
Our program overall advocates for a sustainable agricultural system in the United States. And within that work, we focus in two areas, on the use of antibiotics in animal agriculture and in biotechnology. Our aim in the biotechnology work is to analyze the products to see if they, in fact, bring benefits, to see if their benefits, in fact, outweigh the risks. Generally, because we're skeptical of the benefits and worried about the risks, we have worked a lot over the last 10 years trying to strengthen the regulation of genetically engineered plants in the United States. So to summarize, though some people call us opponents of biotech, we in fact are in favor of strong regulation of biotech products that come to market. Now, in terms of the pharmaceutical plants, the topic for today, we see that these may bring more benefit than any other genetically engineered plants that have been marketed thus far. But as you indicated in your introduction, there are concerns about risks, particularly to the food supply. So it remains unclear just what the benefit-risk equation is going to look like with the pharmaceutical crops.
Could you say a few words about what exactly pharmaceutical or farm crops are?
Surely, I'd be glad to. Some small biotech companies, and now some larger ones, had the idea that some drugs and some vaccines perhaps could be produced in plants, and as you indicated earlier, might be produced in a way that would lower the price of the drug or might make available some drugs that are not available another way. And these companies have, for the most part, employed corn as the organism of choice. What they do is engineer the corn so that it produces a new protein. The protein may be from a gene that's taken from humans or turkeys or any one of a number of organisms. And this gene codes for a protein. Maybe it's a blood-thinning protein. Maybe it's a blood-clotting protein. Maybe it's an antibody. Maybe it's a vaccine. It is using the tools of genetic engineering to make plants produce drugs. Another category which does not get talked about much is industrial crops. In addition to the pharmaceutical crops, companies are engineering plants to produce chemicals that are useful in industry. For example, an enzyme that is used in particle board production. This enzyme is going to be produced in plants. An enzyme involved in the breakdown of wood pulp for the paper making industry. Detergents, enzymes for detergents could be made in plants. So companies are looking at a wide array of proteins and other substances that can be produced after a plant is genetically engineered.
Could you give us some additional plants that are being used to genetically engineer pharmaceuticals and industrial products? You mentioned corn, but
corn is used by far more than any other, but soybeans have been used, rice, tobacco, and alfalfa and rapeseed or canola has also been used. I think safflower has been used in one case. But I do want to emphasize that corn is by far the favorite because it's easy to grow, people know how to grow it, and it is easy to store the drug, the protein, in the kernels of corn. It's a very stable storage system and a very good transport system. So corn is the crop of choice.
How will the pharmaceutical crops be used? Is the idea for people to simply eat an ear of corn with a given amount of a pharmaceutical instead of a pill?
Well, there are actually two ways, and that's one of them. The way that most companies are using the technology thus far in the field is to engineer the plant to produce a protein which is then extracted from the corn or the tobacco and is then purified and sold as a drug. That is the intent. There are some people working on putting vaccines, for example, into crops like potatoes or tomatoes, such that people could consume those products and get immunization against certain diseases. So both of those areas are being investigated. But the one that leads to the purified drug that is then sold is the more popular one. If you look in terms of the numbers of field trials that have been conducted already in the United States.
Could you elaborate on the use of pharmaceutical crops for the production of vaccines? Because one thing that I've read is that, particularly in the developing world, there are problems with refrigeration and so forth, and the feeling is that things you can just eat that have vaccines in them would be easier to store. Could you comment on that and whether you think that, in fact, does hold promise or if there are problems?
I think that, superficially, it is a very attractive idea. It certainly makes sense that if one could have the vaccine in a food crop that doesn't spoil readily and is that does not need to be refrigerated, that is ideal, that it just sounds ideal. But the reality is much, much more complicated. For example, these drugs or vaccines, when produced in a plant, a living plant, are not produced to the same level of certainty as a synthetic reaction that occurs in a test tube or a huge chemical vat. You can't control it. In other words, you cannot predict exactly how much of a vaccine you're going to have in a potato tuber. So it will be very difficult to ensure that a person gets the right amount of vaccine in a potato tuber. Does the person need to eat one or two or a half? It will vary from potato to potato. So we will have to have trained personnel, I believe, available to help people know how much of the food to eat in order to get the right dose. Another problem, these products will be indistinguishable. The potato with the vaccine will be indistinguishable from another potato. How will people keep them separate? What will keep people from eating too much of the vaccine potato if they're hungry and that's the only potato they have left? It is much more complicated in practice. I fear that, like the notion that biotech was needed to feed the world, that a lot of the rhetoric around vaccines for poor people is a way to make people living in the industrialized world, to make them feel guilty that somehow if they don't support biotechnology, that it will end up meaning that poor people will not get vaccines. When I would be very surprised if these so-called oral vaccines would make a significant contribution to disease problems in the developing world. Let's face it, there are many simple solutions to some of the serious diseases in the developing world, and they are not employed because of cost, even though they are cheap. So the intent that the developing world would be the focus for these kinds of activities is no more likely to me than the willingness to spend a few cents per person for some sort of treatment of existing diseases.
What do you see as the major risks of pharmaceutical crops?
By far, the major risk is that these products are going to end up in the food supply. Because people have chosen to use corn, the risk has grown. If you were trying to figure out the worst food crop to use for pharmaceutical production, you would probably come up with corn, because it readily pollinates. That is, the pollen travels long distances. So the pollen containing the gene for the drug might float into fields of corn that are going to be sold for food. The seed that is harvested, some of it might fall to the ground. This seed that has the pharmaceutical product in it might fall to the ground. And it will sprout and come up next year and end up being harvested along with other food crops next year, corn or soybean. The case of Protogene, the company that was recently fined a total of $3 million by USDA because it had failed to properly conduct field trials of pharmaceutical corn, had allowed just that to happen. It had allowed, in one case, it had allowed the corn, the pharmaceutical corn that fell to the ground, they had allowed it to sprout, and it was harvested with soybeans. And eventually 500,000 bushels of soybeans were quarantined and will be destroyed because they have this small amount of pharmaceutical corn in them. Let me say, I was just in a meeting yesterday and I heard a representative of the Food Processors Association say that we must have zero contamination of the food supply. We must have 100% certainty that these pharmaceutical products and industrial products are not going into the food supply. So there's a very real concern among food processors that this technology is not safe. And they are recommending that food crops not be used to grow pharmaceuticals because of the chance that they will get in the food supply. There are obvious risks. I mean, suppose blood thinners are grown in corn. Suppose blood clotters are grown. And even a small amount gets into the food supply. Is it possible that someone could be harmed by that? It is significantly different from the problems we faced with the corn that was produced for herbicide tolerance or BT, insect resistance. So it's a very real problem that these are highly active, in some cases, biologicals that are being produced in corn, which could have effects on humans and animals.
I'm Diane Horn, and we were speaking with Dr. Jane Risler, Senior Staff Scientist at the Union of Concerned Scientists. Our topic is the risks and benefits of plants genetically engineered to produce pharmaceuticals. What type of regulatory framework is in place to address the dangers of pharmaceutical crops?
Along with the risks, this area of regulation is highly controversial because there's a lot of concern that the federal government does not have this technology under control. Up until now, the U.S. Department of Agriculture has been the sole regulatory body overseeing these pharmaceutical crops as they are grown in the field. And there have been field tests in the United States of farm crops, we call them farm crops, P-H-A-R-M, since about 1990 or 91. So we've had at least a decade of field testing. And during that time, the USDA has gradually, to their credit, strengthened the oversight to the point that they now have a fairly strong set of requirements about how the crop should be grown so that the food supply is not contaminated. For example, there has to be a certain distance between the corn crop that's producing pharmaceuticals and any nearby food or feed corn. Also, the companies have to plant the pharmaceutical corn at a time such that when it produces pollen, any of the nearby corn will not be flowering and will not receive the pollen. So there are a number of requirements. However, the problem is USDA does not apply these strict requirements to industrial producing crops. It is not clear that these restrictions do, in fact, keep the genes out of the food supply, the pharmaceutical genes. It is not clear that these requirements actually work. These are requirements that have never been, the latest set has not been subject to public comment. It has not, as far as we know, been subject to scientific review. So we are uncertain that USDA has the right set of requirements. Now, in addition, USDA has not published a scientific risk assessment on these pharmaceutical crops for years. A few years ago, they produced a couple. But in the last few years, they have not provided to the public any assessment of why they think these risks are being controlled by the requirements that they have in place. In other words, it's been a very secretive approval process, which we think is quite inappropriate given the level of concern about these products. So we're not sure that USDA has scientific rigor. It certainly has not had public involvement, and it has not had a transparent process that one can see how they are regulating these crops. We are expecting that the Food and Drug Administration is going to step in at some point with the pharmaceutical crops because the Food and Drug Administration will be regulating the end product, the drug. However, we don't expect that the FDA will play a very strong role in ensuring that the production in the field is safe. They just don't have much authority to ensure the safety of the food supply from these field trials, unfortunately. So what we are asking for is that the USDA not approve any more field trials of pharmaceutical or industrial crops until they have a strong, scientifically rigorous, transparent process in place that has been subject to public comment so that we can be assured that the food supply is safe. So we're asking them to halt their approvals. Unfortunately, I don't think they will do it, but we really are concerned that they do not have a program in place to ensure that the food supply is safe.
What are the steps that could be taken to make pharmaceutical crops safe? What should be the guidelines in your view?
Well, the first thing that USDA must do is to bring together experts on these crops who can advise the USDA of just that. To ask the question, first of all, can corn really be used in any way in the field at the same time that we ensure the safety of the food supply? And if the answer is yes, it is possible to contain corn in such a way that the food supply is safe, then the scientist must lay out what those requirements and restrictions are. Maybe it is that the corn has to be grown in irrigated areas in Utah, something like that, very isolated. Or maybe it is that certain region will have to be zoned only for pharmaceutical corn and no feed and food corn. So I don't know the answer. What I think the department should be engaged in is a scientific public process for determining how we should proceed. In other words, this regulation should not continue behind the closed doors of USDA without scientist advice, without advice from the public.
In your view, what plants would be the best choice for pharmaceutical crops?
I'm slowly, I'm moving toward, this is sort of a backwards way of answering your question, but I am moving towards thinking that food and feed crops probably should not be used. I'm just becoming more convinced as I listen to ecologists that it's going to be very difficult to keep them out of the food supply. So what does that leave? Well, it leaves tobacco. And tobacco, I don't believe, will work as well as corn. And I don't know if there's some plants like kanaf, which is used to make paper, whether there are some other not well-known plants or plants that I don't know of that might be useful. But I think what has to happen is that companies need to know soon whether or not they should continue investing in food crops. I think it's not a good idea, and I think they should be looking for some alternatives.
Are there certain drugs for which it would be unwise to engineer pharmaceutical crops?
I've not tried to categorize that. That could be one approach, to say that we could not put any pharmaceuticals in plants unless they would be non-toxic to humans or animals. But that might limit quite a bit what they could produce in there. So that is one approach. It could be that certain pharmaceuticals could only be produced in crops inside a greenhouse or something like that. I don't know. I frankly haven't thought of separating out different drugs. Part of the problem is I'm not a pharmacist, a drug chemist. I don't know the toxicology of drugs very well. I think probably the approach that has received the most attention is what crop to use.
How close to commercialization are the pharmaceutical crops that are being developed?
I'm glad you asked that, because I hadn't thought to mention that one of the problems is that the public knows very little about what's going on in this area because of so much confidential business information. So that, in fact, we don't have a way of knowing what's close to commercialization. We can depend a little bit on websites of companies, but as you probably know, companies often overstate what's their prospects, so it's not clear what is moving through the system. It is certain that for things to be approved as drugs, that they will have to go through clinical and different kinds of trials with the Food and Drug Administration. But again, that will be all confidential. One of the things that we are pursuing with the U.S. Department of Agriculture is to find some way to release more information to the public, at the same time respecting a reasonable need for confidentiality among companies. But clearly, we are very, very much in the dark about what's being developed and what is on the way to commercialization and where it's being produced.
To the extent that there is information out there, where are the pharmaceutical crops currently being grown?
They're being grown in a number of states. I think maybe 30 states have had tests since 1990. As I say, it's hard to tell because companies can claim even the state where they're doing a test as confidential. But certainly we know that Nebraska and Iowa have been the site of tests. That's where Prodigene was conducting its test with the pharmaceutical corn.
Which companies or universities are involved in pharmaceutical crop production? You mentioned Prodigene.
Yes, Prodigene has been farther ahead than a lot of other companies, but Monsanto is in the business also, as are some small companies that have names like that's Monsanto's, Integrated Protein Technologies. Large-scale biology in California, they work on tobacco primarily. CropTech, which also works on tobacco. Epicyte Pharmaceuticals, I think they're working in rice. There is Symbiosis, a Canadian company, and Meristem, a French company that's doing field testing in the United States. Pilot Therapeutics, Planet Biotechnology, Stauffer Company, which is associated with Prodigene, those are a few of them.
What can our listeners do to help influence public policy on pharmaceutical crops?
for, as your audience knows, it is to be well-informed, and I think you're helping with that goal. People could write to the U.S. Department of Agriculture, and I can give you the name of the person who is head of the office that oversees these products. The person's name is Bobby Acord, A-C-O-R-D, and his office is in Washington, and people could write to him at the U.S. Department of Agriculture, Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service. They could just abbreviate it APHIS, at 1400 Independence Avenue Southwest, Washington, D.C., 20250. They could fax, if you would like that, at 202-720-3054, or send an email at Bobby, B-O-B-B-Y, dot R, dot Acord, A-C-O-R-D, at USDA.gov.
Well, we're almost out of time, but what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
The message is to stay informed, to do just as you have indicated, to try to influence public policy on this important issue. And I think it is important that the government hear that people are concerned that these products from pharmaceutical and industrial crops will contaminate the food supply. At our website, we have an action alert site available that people could send a message to USDA, and we have there a suggested pros for the message, indicating asking USDA to hold off approving these products until they have a stronger regulatory system.
Well, thanks so much for being here.
You're welcome. Thank you.
We have just been speaking with Dr. Jane Risler, Senior Staff Scientist at the Union of Concerned Scientists. For more information, check on the web at www.ucsusa.org. Again, that's www.ucsusa.org.
And that was Diane Horn of Mind Over Matters Radio in Seattle. Brian Tokar is the director of the biotechnology project at the Institute for Social Ecology in Vermont and is the editor of Redesigning Life, the Worldwide Challenge to Genetic Engineering. He spoke at last year's Biodevastation Conference in Toronto on the biotech corporation's historic connection to chemical warfare and environmental disaster.
Back in 1998, as the debates over the genetic engineering of food were first starting to heat up across Europe, the editors of The Economist magazine, probably the leading business magazine in the UK, began their editorial, which was really an impassioned defense of this agenda of genetically engineered food, by saying something quite amazing and quite revealing. Their editorial began, "Agriculture is war by other means." And indeed, the mission of chemical agriculture has been one of warfare. Warfare against our soil, against all the microbes and other living organisms that we depend on for the growing of healthy food, war against the environment, and really ultimately war against ourselves. That is really, in a fundamental way, what this technology is about. And we'll see, as I mentioned, that every one of these companies has played a role in warfare from their origin. The story begins with nitrogen. It's been known since ancient times that nitrogen-based compounds play an important role in soil fertility, and nitrate salts in the form originally of something called saltpeter, which used to be found alongside roadsides and by the foundations of old buildings, were used for many hundreds of years to fertilize soil. The Chinese, of course, in the 12th century discovered that nitrate compounds, when combined with sulfur and a carbon source, are incredibly explosive, and that led to the discovery of and the first development of gunpowder that many centuries ago. During World War I, something very new happened. Two German chemists by the name of Haber and Bosch discovered for the first time an efficient way of chemically synthesizing ammonia, which is a source of nitrate in the laboratory. And that technology was first commercialized by the BASF company, now the world's fourth largest agrochemical company and increasingly a significant player in crop biotechnology. After World War I, there were huge excesses of nitrate-based compounds in the storehouses of all sides in that war, and that led to the beginning of the mass production of chemical fertilizers. DuPont, which now is the sole owner of Pioneer Hybrid, the world's largest seed company, was the single largest manufacturer of gunpowder in the United States throughout the 19th century. They produced 1.5 billion pounds of high explosives for the Allied forces during World War I. The German dye maker Höchst, which in the late 1990s and early 2000 merged with the French Rond-Poulenc to create the biotech giant Aventis, began altering its dye formulations for the development of mustard gas and other poison gases as well as explosives. I should mention that Höchst and DuPont later shared the role of being two of the world's leading manufacturers of CFCs that have resulted in the destruction of the Earth's protective ozone layer. World War I also brought the rise of Monsanto and made it a major player in the world's chemical industry. Over the course of World War I, Monsanto's profits increased by a factor of 100, from $80,000 a year up to well over $9 million. And their game at the time was being a manufacturer of chemical precursors useful in wartime production, particularly phenol, which is a precursor of TNT and also was used as a major battlefield antiseptic. The nitric acid that's responsible for nitrifying the toluene that's made from phenol to make TNT, a number of precursors for the manufacture of poison gas, additives for rubber for various military uses, and so on. That's when Monsanto became a major player and from the 1920s on continued to be in the top 10 of U.S. chemical companies right up until it began divesting its industrial chemical divisions in order to focus on biotechnology in the late 1990s. In addition to manufacture of fertilizers, of course, the other major component of industrial agriculture as we know it is pesticide production. And I'm going to focus in for a little bit on the manufacture and the development of pesticides and the role of these companies in, once again, the parallel development of modern pesticides and modern warfare. In the 19th century and before, pest control was a fairly eclectic enterprise that bore many similarities to the variety of natural pest control methods that we know as organic gardeners and farmers today, using various soaps, herbal preparations, hand removal, and the earliest botanical herbicide, compounds such as pyrethrum and rotenone that began to be known in the 19th century. But the other thing that happened in the middle of the 19th century was the discovery that various byproducts, once again, of the chemical dye industry have important lethal properties. Compounds with names like Paris Green and London Purple were the first mass-produced chemical insecticides. And what these were arsenic compounds. Turns out that during the Victorian era, there were all kinds of arsenic-based compounds in widespread use as dyes for making wallpaper and candles, as cosmetics, as medicinal compounds of various kinds. And it really wasn't until a few decades later that people became aware of how universally toxic arsenic compounds are. The single most widely used pesticide in the early part of the 20th century was, believe it or not, lead arsenate. And it was these same companies that were producing this compound in large quantities. It's also interesting that it was the Europeans that started raising questions about imports of food from the United States that had been treated with lead arsenate herbicide, very much as the Europeans have been in the forefront of resisting genetically engineered foods today. In the 1930s, the technology once again began to shift. It was chemists at the German Bayer Company, which had its origins in dye making, as did all the major chemical companies in Europe at that time. By 1925, Bayer had already been merged into the chemical conglomerate IG Farben, along with all of the other major German chemical companies. And chemists at Bayer discovered that organophosphate compounds are extremely poisonous to a whole host of living things. humans and mammals and insects alike. And with the integration of all of German industry into the Nazi war machine during the 1930s, we saw the combined development of organophosphate pesticides and organophosphate chemical warfare agents. Bayer is in the process of acquiring Aventis Crop Science, the purveyor of Starling corn and other scandals over the last several years. During that period, some 2,000 new compounds were discovered, including such notorious chemical warfare agents as tabun, sarin, and soman gases, which are still being manufactured today. After World War II, we saw the development of organophosphate pesticides, like Fosmet, which is used to spray livestock, and which some researchers have implicated in the development of mad cow disease. Something like 40% of today's insecticide market are still organophosphates, leading to 20,000 cases of acute chemical poisoning every year. These are compounds that send the nervous system into a state of complete havoc. And its mechanism of action against insects is virtually identical to its mode of action in humans and other animals. We're seeing the beginnings of chemical agriculture as we know it taking shape during this period. But the most significant single new development of the World War II period was the development of DDT, because DDT not only increased the use of chemical agents, toxic chemical agents in agriculture, but qualitatively changed the mindset of commercial agriculture in a way that really made it much more in line with the mentality of warfare. DDT was first synthesized in a laboratory in the 1870s, but it wasn't until the 1930s again that scientists at the J.R. Geige Company in Switzerland, in their search for chemical compounds that would be useful to prevent moths from feeding on wool, compounds to disinfect seeds, discovered that DDT was useful for both of those purposes. Geige, of course, merged in the 60s with SIBA to become SIBA Geige, merged with Sandoz in the late 1990s to form Novartis, and spun off its chemical division just about a year and a half ago to create Syngenta, which today is the world's largest manufacturer of chemical insecticides, only to be overtaken by Bayer if it succeeds in its acquisition of Aventis. Also, the world's largest manufacturer of chemical herbicides. Geige developed the use of DDT for some specific purposes, and it began to be sold around Europe. They tried interesting their U.S. division, but there wasn't a whole lot of interest in DDT here because they were able to do essentially the same things with botanical agents like pyrethrum and rotenone. World War II was really what changed all that. During World War II, the U.S. Army faced two very serious pest control problems. One was the widespread outbreak of typhus spread by lice affecting troops in southern Europe, and the other was the potential for widespread outbreaks of malaria in the South Pacific. They were using pyrethrum-based sprays to disinfect their troops, but pyrethrum was seen as being a little too inconvenient in the military climate of those times. Soldiers had to be extensively sprayed on a weekly basis in a very exacting manner. And the military didn't want to have to keep doing that. Also, Japan had by then become a major exporter of pyrethrum, and of course, that source began to be cut off. So DDT, very early on, came to be seen as the wonder compound that was going to instantly solve all these problems. Inside of just a few months, Geige and other companies were producing 2 million pounds a month of DDT. And we're starting to do research on other applications of this compound. It demonstrated its ability to kill many agricultural pests quickly and with long duration and potency. Immediately after the war, it began to see widespread use in public health and soon became the single most widely used chemical insecticide in history. Monsanto began manufacturing DDT in 1944, and about a dozen other companies as well. But aside from the sheer quantity of production, I think the most important thing about DDT is it represented a dramatic shift in the mindset of pest control. And this, again, reflects directly this wartime mentality. DDT was the first agent that promised in their view, the permanent eradication of particular insect pests. And when DDT began to be sold to farmers in large quantities in the late 1940s and early 50s, it was sold as literally the atom bomb of insecticides. Farmers were told that everything they had done in the past to control pests, from botanical controls to habitat control through crop rotation, and again, all of the practices that only began to be revived 10, 15, 20 years later with the beginnings of the organic movement, farmers began to be told that all of these techniques were archaic, were old-fashioned, and should no longer be paid attention to. Research in entomology also underwent a qualitative shift at the time, and Professor John Perkins at Evergreen State College in Washington State has written extensively on this, as well as on the role of DDT in this development. Research in understanding the ecological relationships among pest species virtually came to a standstill, and academic entomology increasingly became a branch of chemical agribusiness. Over this period, 25 new synthetic pesticides were developed. Insecticide production in the United States alone went from being a $10 million business in 1940 to a $100 million business in 1950 to well over $1 billion today, greatly contributing to the coffers of those agrochemical companies that we today know as the gene giants. Of course, in the late 50s and early 60s, people came to understand the problems with DDT, that it accumulates in fatty tissues and in milk, that it contributes to liver and kidney degradation, it's a potent central nervous system poison. Then people on college campuses all over the U.S. that were doing research on DDT began to see that every one of them were losing their entire population of songbirds. People saw that DDT was threatening the survival of the bald eagle. And eventually it was discovered that it contributes directly to the thinning of eggshells. In 1992, the use of DDT was banned for domestic agricultural purposes, although, as many of you know, DDT is still manufactured in the United States for export. Bans followed on a whole host of other organochloride insecticides, like aldrin and dieldrin and chlordane and heptachlor. This was the time, in the early 1970s, when the technology of genetic engineering through gene splicing first became available. This is the period of time when companies like Monsanto began shifting their research agendas toward the application of this new technology. In the late 1970s, they were really worried about the chemical industry's ability to continue controlling the way our food is grown. And they sought genetic engineering as the way to maintain that control. And of course, that led to the whole agenda of aggressive promotion of GE crops in the late 1990s. These various companies continued to play a role in closely collaborating with the military throughout the 1950s and the whole second half of the 20th century. Monsanto's research director, along with scientists from DuPont, were involved in supervising the purification of plutonium and polonium for the development of the atomic bomb, and operated the Army's Oak Ridge Nuclear Weapons Lab. In the 1950s, Monsanto discovered dioxin as a byproduct of the manufacture of chlorinated pesticides like 2,4-D and 2,4-5-T. And at the very beginnings, there are documents going back to 1952 showing collaboration, conversations between Monsanto and U.S. Army scientists about the potential chemical warfare capabilities inherent in dioxin. That came to fruition during the Vietnam War with the massive defoliation of Vietnam through the use of Agent Orange, which was a mixture of 2,4-D and 2,4-5-T. In the 1980s, when a group of Vietnam veterans organizations sued the chemical industry as a result of their own history of horrific side effects from exposure to Agent Orange. Of course, the Vietnamese had no such legal recourse in the United States. There was a court settlement in the mid-1980s where the chemical companies, and there were eight companies altogether implicated, had to pay, I don't have the figure right here in front of me, it was something like $180 million settlement. Even though Dow Chemical was overwhelmingly the largest producer of Agent Orange, Monsanto had to pay almost 50% of that settlement. Why? Monsanto's Asian Orange had 1,000 times the concentration of dioxin as all of the other formulations. Dow Chemical, of course, was also the manufacturer of the gasoline-based incendiary napalm. And you all know about the history of napalm during the Vietnam War. And Dow became a major gene giant in the late 1990s with its acquisition of the biotech company Mycogen and Cargill's entire North American seed division. Of course, Monsanto's role in herbicide production grew tremendously during the 1980s and 1990s. Roundup went from being, and Roundup family herbicides went from being a sixth of Monsanto's revenue a decade or two ago to being the source of more than two-thirds of Monsanto's operating revenue today. So, as we see, pretty much all of the major players in agricultural biotechnology have their roots in this kind of wartime production and these kinds of very systematic relationships with the world's military forces. As the priorities in medical research shift dramatically toward genetic methods and genetic so-called causes, even in cases like cancer, where we know that the increase in cancer rates over the last couple of generations has absolutely nothing to do with genetics and everything to do with the environmental assaults that we're all exposed to on a daily basis. To what extent will it be some of the smaller new biotech companies that over the last many years have come along to develop new diagnostic methods and some of the new drug development and potentially toxin development methods, and what kinds of new mergers and acquisitions and arrangements will be made among companies seeking to take advantage of the $3, $4, $5 billion that the U.S. government is currently pledging to spend on so-called biological defense. Once again, our role in this, as people who are aware of this technology and aware of the relationships among these companies, is to expose their role in this process, expose their nefarious histories, and oppose their efforts to both profit from war and be in the forefront of helping to fuel this new arms race.
That was Brian Tokar, director of the Biotechnology Project at the Institute for Social Ecology, speaking at last year's Biodevastation Conference in Toronto. Thanks to Justin Francese of Free Radio Burlington for the material from the 2002 BioDev Conference. For more information on the biojustice movement and this year's conference, visit www.biodev.org. That's BIODEV.org. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. You can contact us through our website at www.unwelcomeguests.org. If you appreciate hearing this program on 88.1 in Ithaca, please support Ithaca Community Radio, www.ithacaradio.org.